Okay, beautiful. All right. Today is Monday, May 11th, 2020, and a beautiful day here in Yerushalayim, and evidently the news continues to be good because unless I misheard the 6 and 7, 8 o'clock news, there was not one mention of any deaths. And all we were hearing about is how they're loosening the laws. I hope they know what they're doing. The Kavelet Tov. I want to dedicate today's shiur. Yesterday we spoke about Chaya Arbisfeld. To me, he represented all the good in Yeshiva University. We had another tremendous loss last week, not from Corona, from his own illnesses. And that is, of course, Marvin Hershkowitz. To talk about Marvin Hershkowitz, what can I tell you? I was a kid growing up, and like most kids in the Bronx, you looked up to DiMaggio, to Charlie Keller, Tommy Henrik, the Brooklyn Dodger kids. They had their heroes, Jackie Robinson, Pee Wee Reese, Pete Greaser, etc. And here you come to Yeshiva, and by about my second or third year in the greater YU atmosphere, here is an all-state basketball player, Nafshel Chashka B'Torah, wants to be from a kid from the Bronx. I believe it was DeWitt Clinton High School. And you have no idea how we looked up to him. What a basketball player. What a mensch. What a Jew. And I had the skut. I later taught all four of his children. And what a family he and his wife raised. All of them are at Mata Kodesh, all his generations. Vic Snow, in Marvin's illness, Vic used to visit him, I believe it was 3 times a week, to help him and walking, etc., and keep him company. What a great, fabulous individual. I want to tell you a little story. This volume came out in 2005. It's the professor of American Jewish history at YU, Bernard Revel, Jeffrey Gurak. And Jeffrey Gurak himself was a basketball coach, if I'm not mistaken. And he published the volume, Judaism's Encounter with American Sports. In honor of this volume, in exactly May 8th, 2006, it's 14 years ago, almost to the day, Yeshiva University held an event in Gris. It was a beautiful event, and it was called Yeshiva University's Dream Team of the 1950s. And there's a fabulous picture here who came out. Unfortunately, only two are still alive out of the six that you see here. But here's Marvin Hershkowitz right here. I don't know how well it picks up. Standing next to him is Dubby Hartman, Ruby Davidman, L.A. Levine, Jay Citrin, and Natty Krieger. These were all the greatest players on the basketball team, and all of them came in Aliyah, some their whole lives as adults in Israel, others a little bit later. But what a compliment to YU, and what a mensch. There aren't enough words to tell you about Marvin. This is the chesed that his son, my dear Talmud, Stewie Hershkowitz, gave. Stewie Hershkowitz was the vice president of Machon Lev. And there, too, the way his children turned out, Stewie, his brother, his sisters, just a tremendous credit to Marvin and his wife. And life moves on. But this is YU at its finest. One little tidbit that many of you know, but it's worth repeating. Because of Marvin Hershkowitz, we have the Jewish Studies program. And it's interesting, I'll come back to that in a different context in another moment. But before Marvin Hershkowitz, to go to any branch of YU, You had to know how to learn. You had to know how to handle a Gemara. And here's this kid who wants to be Shomer Torah Mitzvot. And he wants to go to YU. He has all types of offers to universities and whatnot and basketball scholarships. And no, he wants to go to YU. So he gets hold of the coach, Red Saracek. Saracek goes to Dr. Belkin. Dr. Belkin says to him, how can we take him in? Ken Garnish, he knows nothing. He just went to Talmud Torah. And Red Saracek says, please, you don't know what it means. It'll put YU on the map. It'll get us publicity. It'll bring in money, a basketball player like Marvin. And finally, Dr. Belkin picks up a phone to Moshe Beistin. It's the brother of Abe. There was Abe and an older brother, Morris, Moshe Beistin. And they were Talmidim of Rabbi Belkin from the 30s. And he had confidence in them. And he says, do me a favor, organize a program for this kid. We got to bring him in. They organized a special program. It was the subdivision of TI, a Teachers Institute. And that's how the Jewish Studies program begins. The other side of the coin is when Marvin's wife died, Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein came to Nachum Avil, and he confessed with Ne'am Vieda, this was about 53, if I'm not mistaken, he demonstrated against the organization of a special program for kids with no background. It'll ruin the yeshiva, it'll corrupt the yeshiva. And there was the Babe as a youngster demonstrating along with others. I plead not guilty on this level because I was too young. I was just in high school. I was still in very short pants. Later, I do plead guilty. When Stern College was organized, the Mashgiach gave a whole shmuz against it. So I made lachem against it. You fin enough from gas. I don't want to translate. And I did demonstrate against Stern College at Chata'ai Ani Mashgiach Hayom. So I mentioned Marvin Yehi Zichro Baruch, and we should only have good news from this point further. I want to tell you a very interesting article surfaced from a Hebrew newspaper writing about Brisk Litter practically 100 years ago, 1910, more than 100 years ago, 110 years ago. And this is Rabbi Meller, who's writing about the Brisker family, showing it to the one last grandson of Rav Chaim, should live really well, Adbiat Goel, that's Rabbi Shulam David Soloveitchik. And he's showing him the article about his father, grandfather with the cholera epidemic in 1910 in the Brisk, where Rav Chaim Paskin, everyone has to eat on Tisha B'Av, and not just by day, they can't even fast by night. Once you're allowed to eat, you have to eat already on the start of the fast. More than that, Reb Chaim Paskin, that you can't leave the chalent on all night. It seems they didn't have the sophisticated ovens we have, and it could go putrid, sour, and during a cholera epidemic, this is not good for your stomach. It weakens you. He said, let the Gentiles make the chalent and take it and bring it to the Jews. And it's all there in the article. So it's amazing what surfaces. Also, tying together my words on Marvin Hershkowitz, I have a slight correction to make. Although I'm proud that my memory is good, but it was imperfect. I mentioned to you about Rabbi Nathan Blumen, this podcast from Beit Shemesh and Rabbi Gebera. And I mentioned that he had a great achievement with the Haim brothers that he influenced. So I mentioned that this happened in the Newport News, I think. So Rabbi Blumen's daughter got in touch with a Talmud of mine. He evidently made available that at the Shia to her, and she corrected me that her father's first shtela was in Danville, Virginia, and that's where he met the Hain family. Later, Rabbi Blumen goes to Newport News, but the Hain brothers, all four, the youngest one, by the way, is Uri. I didn't mention his name last time. All four are from Danville, Virginia. So I stand corrected. Where does this tie in with Marvin Hershkowitz? So Toby Katz, the daughter of Rav Nachman Bulman, Nathan Bulman, found among her mother's papers when her mother died, she went through the papers, and there she finds a letter from Yeshiva University after the first Haim boy arrived in YU, quote, "Please don't send us any more Haim boys. He is completely unprepared for the yeshiva." And of course, this is a Talmud Torah graduate coming to Yeshiva's Gebzis Kohanan. And imagine, had the Rabbi Bulman listened to what the office in New York told him, how much poorer the Jewish people would be today. So Baruch Hashem, as we spoke about yesterday, there's a lot of divine guidance. There's a lot more than just the individual. Yes, it all begins with the individual. Emet me eretz titzmach. Yeah, we're on the ground, but never forget that we're enveloped by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And let me pick up where we left off. We're in the, I wouldn't say the golden years of the RCA, but these are very fascinating years, because the Rav plays a dominant role as chairman of the Halachic Commission. Of all these problems that are coming up, some of them that haunt us until this very day. What we saw last week and what we're going to see time and again, the Rav, very hard to define him. As I told you more than once, you can open up when the Rav died, or has paid them given. Some of the has paid them I read, they portrayed the Rav as the biggest right winger in the world, as I said last week. No difference between him and Rav Aaron Kotler. This was published in Tradition. Just Rav Aaron reached American 41, the Rav reached American 32. All right, that was Rabbi Meiselman. There was a Hesped that came out of Ramaz, published in the Kehilat Jeshurun Bulletin, and it described the Rav in absolute Ramaz terminology, what Ramaz stands for, and moderation, and understanding the American scene, and perhaps a more liberal approach. And I want to tell you, both descriptions are correct. It's not the total picture of the Rav, but the man had within him, as you saw last week, he gets hysterical. Ain't of us kenish definin a Gemara. Ebet apkaitchin chumish. Someone who can't open a Gemara, doesn't know which way to hold a Gemara, he's going to explain the words in chumish. Remember what he wrote about the JPS translation. Believe me, that's kana'ut. On the other hand, you understand very well when the Rav speaks about relations with Catholics, with relations with conservative reform, everything we touched upon last week with relations with the general Zionist who was far from Torah and Mitzvah at that time, he had an understanding. There was a liberality. There was an attempt to meet them, to coalesce with them. And I have to tell you, you can understand that the Rav was very multifaceted, and his personality was one that it's very hard to pin down black, white, gray. There are various aspects to him. We have to strive. We have to try to understand him. I had one advantage in knowing the Rav is that I knew Rav Aaron Kotler before I knew the Rav. And although I didn't know Rav Aaron as well as I knew the Rav by far, but I have to admit that you're looking at it, an idiot. I gave Rav Aaron, I told him, I'm ashamed to repeat it, but I said to him, could you imagine a kid of 17 saying this to Rav Aaron Kotler, that B'nai Akiva, I found truth, Torah Yisrael, Lam Yisrael, Api Torah Yisrael, and he answered me, nothing, Mishnah Gansen, but he didn't slap my face, he said, no, you have more to go, like that's a stepping stone to go further and reach more. But I understood Rav Aaron in retrospect later, when I had broadened my knowledge, I understood Rav Aaron very well. And it helped me understand the Rav very well. And my greatest joy is, if you've heard what I have to say about the Rav, and I spoke about him 22 years in the Kollel in my Monday class, the class I'm teaching now, you'll find that that his daughter, Dr. Tova Soloveitchik Lichtenstein, and Ani Rothkopf, Aaron Rekefet, they're almost exactly the same words in understanding the Rav. So I'm very proud to say, I think the daughter understands her father. And we're going to come back to this and time again. Now, I want to go a drop further. By the way, Jack, don't write anyone down for 36 grand yet on the IOU list, because I may not reach the conservative ticket today. We'll try, but by next week, you can go through with the IOU list. I have to give a drop of background here. And I don't know if anyone looking at me can still remember this. Let me tell you a true story. I had a classmate, Milti Gittelman. We were very close. Gitzi, we used to call him Gitzi. Gitzi lived in the Bronx a few blocks from me. And one summer, his parents rented a Far Rockaway, if I'm not mistaken. It was a summer resort. And you would rent a house there, rent an apartment. People who owned a home there during the summer, they would go traveling, go on vacation, and they rented out their place for what was good money at the time. Everyone wanted to be near the beach. Fine. So we're in this house, and Gitzi invites me for Shabbos. His parents were Shomrei Torah Mitzvot. And as I recall, his sister, if I'm not mistaken, married a JTS graduate. And we're kids, we're high school kids. So we're exploring the house. We come down to the basement, and in the basement, there's a curtain, a big curtain. We pull the curtain apart, and they have a library there, book on top of book on top of book. What was the library? All in English, translations of the Communist Party. Translations of the Congress, the first Congress, the second Congress, the third Congress, the plans, the Politburo, the discussions, the achievements. You have no idea how many Jewish boys, Jewish girls growing up in America, the late 20s into the 30s, I hope by the 40s, it sort of quieted down. The communist idea, Mashach Kasam, it was enticing, like a siren, like a murmured, oh, what ideas. The world belongs to the workers. There is no poverty. No one has to worry about money. Everyone has a job, everyone has an income, each one gives according to his abilities, and each one receives in accordance with his needs. This youth, at most, had a Talmud Torah education. It's not like today, Rabbi Kites said, it was a Meredith Vater, Rabbi Pinchas Mordechai Kites of Elizabeth. He said, when you come into a house in America, in the 20s, the 30s, even the 40s, and you found Sfarim, you knew that it was the grandfather's Sfarim. Today, in the 60s, the 70s, you come into a house and you find Sfarim, it's the grandson. The grandfather can barely open up a sefer, and there's the grandson with Shas Cheskim, with Shainim Achreinim. You have no idea how many Jewish boys were led Communist ideals, fabulous. Later they were disillusioned. I think they were disillusioned quicker in America than in Israel. If you saw some of the May Day newspapers here, May 1st, they had pictures of the kibbutzim marching with pictures of Stalin, or still in the 50s when Jews were being killed and exiled and executed. Oh, we banish Elohim. I think in America, they woke up earlier. But if I can quote Jacob Beanstalk, again, I'm quoting people that are alive to me. To you, it's a name that maybe you heard or didn't hear about. Jacob Beanstalk was the biggest expert in the world on people who wrote about the Rambam. He was head of the Gottesman Library at YU. He's very close to the Rav. And I don't know, I had a skud as a kid. I became very close to these people. And maybe they served me a spark that one day I'll teach Torah in Yerushalayim. They were kind to me. So we had some very nice conversations about Gedolei Yisrael in Europe. I don't want to mention names. He told me about Gedolei Yisrael, who in their youth, the most famous Rosh Yeshiva, were practically card-carrying members of the Communist Party of the Bund. And I remember he said to me, Arnie, you don't understand. For these people, it was a dream. If you weren't a Bundist, a socialist, a communist, you had no youth. It's like today in America, you're in Shoma Hadati. These kids in mind, Shoma Hadati, today it's B'nai Akiva. If you don't belong to B'nai Akiva, you aren't young. You haven't had a youth. You haven't had a dream. And so many were communists. Now, how does this come up with the RCA? Very simple. What became of these Jewish boys? Many of them became medical doctors. Many of them became accountants. Many of them became lawyers. Many of them became teachers. During the McCarthy period, they were hunting down anyone who had communist affiliation. The Rav once said that, I hope I'm quoting him correctly, but the gist is correct. McCarthy, Senator McCarthy, didn't know the concept of tshuva. This concept he didn't know. So it reached New York, and they started questioning the teachers. Who is a communist? Who knows about communists who are teaching? And in October 1953, I'm quoting from Louis Bernstein, but I remember this living it, hearing about it. Saul Muskoff, then the Assistant Corporation Council of New York, turned to Rabbi Teddy Adams, the president of the RCA. This Saul Muskoff, you see, was Jewish, belonged to a shul, actually was vice president of a shul, and he asked the question, can we start investigating the communist infiltration of the American public school system and insist that the teachers tell us who is a communist, who does he know, give us names, and Elliot will check everybody out. And he quoted to Rabbi Adams, he says, and every day in davening, I say, l'malshinim al tehisikva. So could you imagine that this question, can you inform on communists, comes to the RCA, and Teddy Adams turns to the Rav. And here you have to understand the Rav. There was no one more American than the Rav. He loved America. Tova, his daughter, who I spoke about a minute ago, Dr. Tova Lichtenstein, once said, we were discussing, after all, I have to say, we take a little bit credit in the many aliyot that came after us. Malka and I were like Nachshon Ben Aminadav. But when people saw the Rothkops could go and not run back to America, maybe there is a future in Eretz Yisrael, despite what was said at the farewell party Rabbi Belkin made for me. And Tova said a good word. She said, you know the difference between us and our parents? Our parents gave kiddush when they became American citizens. Of course, my parents were born in America, but my grandparents. We gave kiddush when we left America to go on Aliyah. And here's the Rav getting this question. I'll tell you another story that just came to me yesterday. My neighbor is Professor Kami Horowitz. Probably some of you heard the name. Professor Horowitz is a Talmud Mufak of Professor Yitzchak Tversky, Isidore Tversky. All right, some of you knew Professor Tversky, Tolle Rebbe, quite well. I knew him quite well as well, even though I didn't live in Boston. And Kami Horowitz told me he was at the bar mitzvah It happened as follows. We're speaking about letters. He just went through letters that he wrote to his parents when they were alive, when they were here in Israel already, and he was still in Chutz Laretz in Boston. And he writes to his parents about Meir Twersky's Bar Mitzvah. And at the Bar Mitzvah, they sang Hatikvah. And the Rav insisted, at the Bar Mitzvah was in Shul Shabbos, and they made a prayer, Leman HaMedina. Prayer for the Medina that we all make on Shabbat. The Rav insisted, you make a prayer for the Medina, that's beautiful, but then you have to make a prayer for the United States. You follow? It's like I don't want to call it a halacha, but the practice is, if you have an Israeli flag in shul, you have to have an American flag, all right? If you sing Hatikvah, you have to sing the Star Spangled Banner. And this was the Rav, America, and he was raised in Europe. He could appreciate America. This is the big difference between him and Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik. There's a world of difference in their basic hashkafa towards Israel, America, the Vietnamese War, and Rakefet once explained, it's easy to understand. The Rav came to America, he saw the worst of Europe. He kissed the stones of America. Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik reached America by mitzvah boy. He was raised in America. He never saw the communists. His only recollection of Europe is Warsaw. The Rav had, if you've studied the Rav by yours truly, you see when the Rav talks about communism, he's shaking, he's shivering. When people told the Rav Rebbe that their Balei Tshuva in Russia, is the 1970s when he had a Paskin Shilas for our operation, the Rav couldn't have Balei Tshuva to come in. We had guys thrown out in Shabbos, the KGB, Mr. Putin, threw out two of my shluchim on Shabbos. They remembered his picture this is him as a youngster. He sat opposite them. He was head of the KGB in Leningrad, St. Petersburg today, or Petersburg they call it. And the Rav, Rebbe, they're thrown out in Shabbos. You know what the Rav answered? Communist KGB throws you out, no Shabbos. You take your suitcase, they take you to the airport, they put you on a plane. Shabbos doesn't come back until you're in Helsinki, quote, end quote. The fear, the pachad, oh, wow. And here he gets a shaila like this. What do you do? On one hand, you have the Kanayin Hara, America, and on the other hand, communism. So you should know the Rav struggled with this and reached a conclusion, absolutely not allowed to inform. Mesira is Mesira. For the informers, there is no hope. And he paskened la halacha that you're not allowed to inform. Interestingly enough, this psak conflicted with the opinions of the conservative and reform rabbinate. They paskened, America comes first, communism is terrible, allowed to inform, pikuach nefesh of the American democracy, infiltration of communism, everything that McCarthy was saying. And the Rav, with all his dialectical tension, his love for America, his enmity towards communism, but halacha is halacha, mesira is mesira, and chas v'chalila, that we should be meiser. I'm teaching in Bronx High School of Science, and I know that these five guys have communist literature in their basement. And you got to remember the other thought that I said before, who says they're still communists? That was when they were growing up in the 1930s, perhaps the early 40s. Russia went to war. Russia fought valiantly. I have to give all the credit in the world. Who knows what would have been if Russia had not gone to war, if the communists, if the Nazis had walked over Russia, it would have freed their troops. God have mercy. Perhaps we wouldn't be sitting here. But we had a miracle. Russia fought valiantly. And you all know the winter 1942, the German army was not prepared for such a cold winter. Their supply system went under, like Napoleon many years earlier. And Baruch Hashem, that took away Nazi troops and power and money, and it enabled the Allied forces to do what they had to do. So tshuva is tshuva. They, yes, you believe, but time wore on. Stalin was Stalin. 1948, killing all the Jewish intellectuals. You had to wake up if you had any type of intelligent mind. Tshuva is tshuva. What was, but Nasir is forbidden. And that was a famous psak of the Rav. It's interesting that today, if a question like this came up with the state of religious observance in America, knew what would the Reform and Conservative say and what would the Orthodox say? At that point, what Orthodox Jew was Republican? Everyone was a Democrat. Today, what Orthodox Jew is a Democrat? Everyone is a Republican. Reform and Conservative? Big Democrats until today. Very interesting shift in mentality. But halacha lemaisa, this was the Rav's psak. It's a famous little issue, and it's interesting to see how the Rav handled it, and it becomes more fascinating when you know the Rav's background, where he came from, where he went to, and his attitude towards the United States, and his attitude towards communism, and what he saw in his youth when they took over Haslovich. Okay. 1954, a very famous interview is given by the Rav. It appears in the Tag. It's not the religious Yiddish newspaper, but the more, I would say, secular Zionist Jewish newspaper. Although later on, the Tag and Mogensher, now as you have less Yiddish readers, they combine. But this interview becomes classic for what is going to go on in the future. And what I'm referring to is, here we have to understand, again, going back 100 years, and I mentioned it in my lectures, you'll ask Rabbi Goldstein, or Rabbi Drachman, 120, 130 years ago, do we talk with Reform rabbis, conservative rabbis? Absolutely. It was never a question. We're all Jews. We're all part of the same body. We're all part of Judaism. We have differences, but of course we talk. We have to be together. We have to be united. We're one people. There's no question. No one ever raised the issue before World War I about sitting with Reform and Conservative. The first time the issue ever comes up is in the late 20s, the early 30s in Boston. It's the first time the issue ever surfaces. It's basically before the Rav gets there, although when the Rav is there already, it also surfaces at times. But there was never a question that that which unites us is infinitely more important than that which divides us. Now, you can also say, and there's a lot of truth to this, the Orthodox weren't as frum as they are today, and the Reform weren't as Reform. I mean, and that is true. Who would ever dream in the 1920s that the Reform movement would recognize you as Jewish if your father was Jewish, not your mother? No one could dream of that. It would be an impossibility. It was so ingrained in the Jewish people that our religion follows the matriarch, the mother, not the patriarch, not the father. All right. With World War II, we picked up many, many refugees. They either went to Israel or they came to the United States and Canada. Again, Australia picked up some, South Africa picked up some, England picked up some, but compared to the numbers of Israel, Palestine, and United States, Canada, that's where the bulk went. Among these immigrants, for the first time in history, people are coming to America, to Canada, not to run away from Europe, but to save their lives. They're not coming to give up Yiddishkeit. It's not like the 10s, the 20s, the 30s, basically. If you're coming to America, Canada, you're coming to a treif in the land, and you know in advance, your kids may not even be Jewish at all, or at best, Mechalolei Shabbos, Ochlin, the Verit, and Treifet, or Noah Maven. All right. Now, there was a base. It's not like the immigrants say, or like you read some of the art scroll books, there was no Yiddishkeit in the Western world until we came and built Torah. Totally incorrect. The basis was there. Yes, there were Gedolei Rabbanim already. There were yeshivot. But there's no question that it took a tremendous step forward when the masses came in, Hasidim, Mitzvakim, and they want to be no different than their grandparents in Europe, right here in the United States, right there in the United States. All right. Well, slowly but surely, the question started to arise. How do we relate to Reform and Conservative? And this question didn't happen overnight. It's gradual. When you first arrived in America, you were a greenhorn. You didn't speak English. You didn't know what was going on beyond your shtibble and your block. But within 10 years, take 45 to 55, within 10 years, many of the greenhorns spoke a fine English. Many of the greenhorns opened up the New York Times to acclimate. Many of the survivors went to college, broke their teeth, got degrees. Herbie's sitting there, a graduate of pharmaceutical school. I told you when he came out of the Holocaust, he didn't know how to read or write. Herbie told me, Chaim Wolfs told me. We know each other since 62. So, well, now you know a little bit what's going on. I can't say Rabbi Aaron Cutler knew America intimately. I can't say Rabbi Moshe Feinstein knew America intimately. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky had a reputation. He came originally to Toronto, and from there he comes to America. They say he knew America better than others. They say Reb Zelig Epstein already was, his English became his native language. That's what I'm told. Got a bachelor's, a master's, and read the New York Times, and can comment on it in a top quality English. All right. So they looked around, Reform, Conservative. This issue started to surface. I need not tell you this issue will haunt American Jewry for 40, 50 years. Today already it's off the agenda because there basically is a split that's irrevocable to a certain degree between the Torah world and the non-Torah world. But this issue haunts us 40, 50, 60 years. In this interview with the Tag, and you got to remember too, 1954, this interview is epic making because it's really the first time that the Rav is going public. The Rav had a lot of Akmas Nefesh in Boston. If you read the Rav, I say it there, I've been quoted and requoted, and I quote Tova Lichtenstein, and I quote Menachem Ganek. I mean, I quote the people that know what went on in Boston. There's no question that to a certain degree, it caused him to have this feeling, don't take public stands, don't get involved in issues beyond the classroom. He was very hesitant. He was burned. Let's use contemporary English. He was scorched. He saw what can go on with the public atmosphere and the crowd and people and on my arets and people who have self-interest and monetary issues, etc. He was very quiet. When I learned in Lakewood, one of the biggest criticisms I heard time and again of the Rav, that he doesn't take public stands. Rav Aaron comes out in public and fights, and the Rav, you don't hear his voice, Manda Hashmei. All right, they didn't know who the Rav was and what he had gone through, and Rav Aaron didn't know America that well. He felt he could get away with public stands and go further, fine. But by 1954, this interview was groundbreaking, and I just want to quote the heart of it. And again, he's dealing reform, conservative, and he spoke, and you saw this when we spoke about other issues last week, but here he clarifies his thinking. I'm quoting word by word. This is an English translation of the Yiddish interview. When representation of Jews and Jewish interests, klapei chutz, vis-a-vis the non-Jewish world are involved, all groups and movements must be united. There can be no divisiveness in this area, for any division in the Jewish camp can endanger its entirety. And here's the most famous part now. In the crematoria, the ashes of Chassidim and Anshei Maisa, pious Jews, were mixed with the ashes of radicals and freethinkers. And we must fight against the enemy who does not recognize the difference between one who worships and one who does not. End quote. And here you have the basis of what the Rav would develop in relation to all the questions that would come up with Board of Rabbis, Synagogue Council, Klapei Chutz and Klapei Pnim. When it's matters of the Jew vis-a-vis the rest of the world, anti-Semitism, economic issues, social issues, we have to be united. When it's a question of klapei pnim, halacha, a siddur, a chumash, a translation, abortion, any issue you'll take, when it's halacha, unity does not count. We surrender to the Divrei Hashem. And this is why in any of our relations with Reform and Conservative, klapei chutz, we're all equal, we all have a say. Klapei pnim, the Orthodox must have veto power. And this paragraph, this interview, absolutely reflects on all the Rabbinical Council of America policy in the decades to come. There will be endless fighting. We spoke about it already. Rabbi Hollander, Rabbi Bernstein, Rabbi Rachman. Do we meet with Reform and Conservative? Don't we meet with Reform and Conservative? But the Rav's position, a dialectical tension, the hardest position to take. So much easier to say, push them away. They're not our cup of tea. So much easier to say, embrace them, love them, hug them. We are blood brothers. Whether we eat chametz on Pesach or not, but the Rav's position right in the middle. And then you always have to deal with the issue. What is klapei pnim? What is klapei chutz? Where does halacha play a role? Where doesn't it play a role? And this position guided the RCA on all these issues right until the 21st century. We'll talk about it at a certain point in the 1990s, or when it was 96, the synagogue council disbanded. And there was great joy. I happened to be at the OU convention that year. I was one of the featured speakers. And in the middle of the convention, one of the OU rabbinic leaders came in Friday night, I remember right before Kabbalat Shabbat, with a very dramatic announcement. And he announced the synagogue council has disbanded itself. And in front of the whole Olam, he made a Shechiyahu, B'Shem U'Malchut. And I remember I was standing right next to Rabbi Lau, chief rabbi at the time. And I turned to Rabbi Lau and I said, Teda lecha kvod harav harashi shezo brocha levatala. Who is takel alai? Amati ze pashut. Im ze tov, habracha hanachona hatova hametiv. Ze tov lechol hayehudim, lo rak lo ishi, individuali. It's the right bracha. It's like you're at a table Friday night, and you had red wine, and now you have white wine, and you're sharing it with others. Hatova hametiv. If it's only for you, then a shechiyanu. But if it's for you and other Jews, hatova hametiv. So that bracha was shechiyanu. I don't know. It should have been either hatova hametiv or Baruch Dayan Emet, but Shechiyanu plays no role. Anyway, later that year, I was together with Rabbi Soloveitchik in the Old City, and I said to Rabbi and Rebbe, what's Freiman Zichase? What are we so happy about? By the way, Rabbi always spoke English with, but there's certain terms that to me is a mitzalzel in Yiddish more than in English. So I said to Rabbi, what's Freiman Zich? What are we so happy about? My Rebbe, your brother, was not against synagogue council. We did have a veto power. So that's where Rabbi told me what I said before, that you're right. But could be today my brother, Zecher Tzadik Lebracha, would have been totally opposed because they've gone very far. And that was with the patriarchal, that the father transmits Judaism, that throws the whole carpet out from under where we're standing. So that's what the Baron answered me. But this statement by the Rav lives on and colors RCA thinking for the next 40, 50 years. Now, with the Rav in command of the Halachic Commission, he now gets other questions that he has to deal with. And some of them, the military chaplaincy, by now you will know, the graduates of Yeshiva University, RCA members, are well integrated into the military chaplaincy. And questions come up that are very unique. It's not Israel. We don't have questions like this because either what we do on Shabbos is permitted and it's bitachon shotef, what's called batash, so you never have a question like this. But if it's not bitachon shotef, according to the rules of the Israeli army, you're not allowed to do any public shilul Shabbos in the name of the army. Technically speaking, if a general takes an army jeepom on Shabbos to visit his wife and children, he's technically not allowed to use an army jeep. All right, these are like laws that you can have on the books in some states that adultery is forbidden today. If anyone commits adultery, he's a hero. He's in the front pages. He's a Hollywood-style guy. He's a politician. I need not tell you how we're alive today. Laws can only be enforced if people care to enforce them and observe them. But these questions don't arrive in the Israeli army. They do arrive in armies that are not Jewish armies. And here I see Yitz is listening, but he can't speak. I'd love his input on this because he was a chaplain. And here's a question the Rebbe received from the Korean War. Is it permissible to travel on the second day of Rosh Hashanah? A chaplain asked this. He was on a major maneuver during the Cold War in Germany, and the troops were moving on the second day of Rosh Hashanah. He wanted to know if he should attempt to switch with the Reform rabbi, who had no objection to traveling on the holiday. And here you have a classic question. If you're not going to do it, it could be that the army will understand you're an Orthodox rabbi. So they'll get a Reform rabbi to move on with the troops on second day Rosh Hashanah. You have to understand that, what does this mean? You're making a statement to the army and to your troops that we cannot be spiritual leaders for all of you. We are limited only to those that will accept what we consider the proper dictum of the Torah. It's a delicate question. Well, on the other hand, we have to understand second day Rosh Hashanah is not a din d'oraita, it's a din d'rabbanan. No, once it's a din d'rabbanan, perhaps under these circumstances, one can be more lenient. And the Rav's answer was very clear. The Orthodox chaplain should not travel unless it meant violation of a direct order which could lead to a court-martial. And even if it meant that a Reform rabbi who did not observe the second day of the holiday would replace the Orthodox one, he should give up and let the Reform rabbi come in. So, you see, this is a classic question. But interesting that if it would result in a court-martial, the Rav was willing to let the Orthodox rabbi travel on second day Rosh Hashanah. And I imagine that would require someone from the army to tell us, when an order like this is given, is the army insistent, you're the chaplain, you're in command, you're in this position, you're in this post? Shevi Altar says not shayach, or you face a court martial, or no, there's a bit of choice. The head chaplain of the entire unit division is some Catholic who knows there's a difference between Reform and Orthodox. Fine, let the Orthodox chaplain stay back and let the Reform rabbi take over. Very fascinating.
Do you want Yitzchak to answer?
Excuse me?
You want Yitzchak to answer?
Can Yitzchak answer? Yitzchak? We're not getting anything. Okay, so anyway, this was the Rav's ruling. There was a similar question that I quote in the Rav in my work on my Rebbe, where I quote him word by word with his whole answer. I believe I translated it from, he spoke about it at a YURA convention, if I'm not mistaken. Check it out, a YU Rabbinic Alumni Convention. And I believe it was in Yiddish, and I translated from the Yiddish to the English. But the Rav got a question. If you recall, there was an inspection of a unit on second day Yontif. And when the army's inspected, those of you that did basic training, you all know, yeah, if you, and today in the Israeli army, I think the American army too, I'm not certain, if you have a beard, you're allowed to have a beard. In the Israeli army, when I went in 76, so the rule was, if you had a beard for 30 days already, you're allowed to keep your beard. I don't know if they enforced it. I think if you had a beard, they let you keep your beard. But the army wants discipline. So when you're being inspected, your shoes have to shine. And I brought Vaseline. My wife gave me a great idea. She said, take Vaseline with you. Whenever I polish my shoes, put a little Vaseline on, everybody looked at me. It was, wow, this is only Rak Amerikayim Makirim Trik Kazeh. Only the Americans know a trick. That's a nice new Hebrew word, a trick. Well, they also use a kunz, a nice Jewish word in Hebrew, kunz Kazeh. And you have to be clean shaven. So the Rebbe got that question from Rabbi Shulman, his famous Talmud, the Rabbi Shulman's a family well connected with Yeshiva University today. They're faculty members from the family. Lamdanim, Rabbi Shulman, who was married to a niece of Rabbi Chaim Isaac Brzezinski. And I remember the Rebbe got that question and also told him that he doesn't believe he should shave and he has to stand firm on religious principle, etc. But fascinating question. Another question that the Rebbe got during the same era was the main services in the army were Friday night. It seems in the Korean War yet, main battles were fought by day, not by night. Today, I don't know if there's a difference between night today because we have night sight. My son-in-law, should live and be well, helped develop this on the Israeli army on the Merkabah 2 and the Merkabah 3. I told you, he once came home at about 12 midnight. I was much younger than I could stay up to 12, 1. And we stood on my terrace and he said to me, Abba, take these binoculars and look out. And I take the binoculars, I look into them and it was pure daylight. I could see everything, the Knesset, the Israeli Museum, the Hilton Hotel, and it was absolute pure daylight. And they developed this so they can fight by day, by night. But here, the main services are Friday night. Now, you talk about a chaplain, so he's stationed in, and he's servicing the soldiers that are Jewish that are miles and miles around. When you held the service Friday night, all they're going to do, buses are going to come, endless buses, could be driven by non-Jews, and everyone is traveling on Shabbos to come to shul, lachatchila, because there's no way to hold the services without arranging all these buses. And it sounds, this is the question of shuls and parking lots, but here it's absolute. There's no other way to do it. It's not like I could hold the davening in Maplewood, New Jersey. And all right, so there were cars parked a few blocks away, but I had people living within walking distance. Here, the buses, non-Jewish drivers, and or should the chaplain here, evidently it was no problem, he could drop out of it and allow a colleague of his, a Reformed rabbi, to conduct the services. And here the Rebbe responded that he could not find the basis to grant such permission, even if the vehicle would be driven by a non-Jew. He realized that such an action might accentuate the difference between Orthodox and Reform and Conservative services, but still, the Rebbe could find no justification for desecrating the Shabbat. So here you see again, we who are Torah Jews, you get involved, the chaplaincy, an American army, a British army, a Canadian army, how much can we do? Shabbat services, Friday night, buses, the Rebbe would not be matir. And it's a shame that these original questions, we don't have the Rebbe's written answers, if there were written answers. All this material, but there had to be. I'll tell you, if he quotes this, so it shows that Louis Bernstein had written documents in front of him or minutes of the meetings of the Halachic Commission. All this was lost when the RCA moved from office to office. Okay, now let me go one step further. Something that I alluded to a week ago. The question of Yom HaTzmut. How do we celebrate it? And I remember I showed you last week, I have the first Yom HaTzmut little matzah published by the chief rabbinate in Israel. And this is a problem that haunts us until today. Again, how do we celebrate Yom HaTzmut? This year, it was low key. But in Israel, if I would say what is unique about Yom HaTzmut, it's the barbecues, the mongolim. No, is a mongol a kiyum of Yom HaTzmut? All right, you can say you want to have a sudat mitzvah, fine. But we lack Hanukkah, we lack Purim, we lack Chazal, we lack something unique. All right, maybe one day we will uncover a unique celebration that will add sanctity and meaning and destiny to Yom HaTzmut. All right, but we're doing what we can. Certainly to say Hallel. Then you add Mizmorei Tehillim, and the Rav was a little upset. It's like Friday night. It's like I told you more than once in my shul on Yom HaTzmut and in Yom Yerushalayim, they say the long Pesukei D'Zimra like on Shabbos and Yom Tov. And I told them, and I can't argue, I can't fight. These are people I love, I've gotten with for decades. I said, you're a bunch of ignoramuses. I can open my mouth. You guys claim you know how to learn. The big question is why we say the long Mizmorim on Hoshana Rabbah. Charlie, you say on Hoshana Rabbah? Jack, you say on Hoshana Rabbah? No. Tell me, if you say in Hoshana Rabbah, how come you don't say the day before? What's Hoshana Rabbah different? You remember Abi Ezri, Jack? He once smacked my face because I said a guten kvittel. He got hysterical. Oh my gosh, my ayin lakar, kvittel, mazem, mizem, me, tamukubal. This is a yaka wanted, wow, he was furious with me that I said a guten kvittel to him. All right. We'll leave Hoshana Rabbah, fine. I'm not telling you not to say it. I also say it. What can I do? But it's a din in Issa Malacha. When there's a full Issa Malacha, like Shabbos and Yom Tov, that's when you say the long Mizmorim. Now, what does that have to do with Yom HaTzmut? What does that have to do with Yom Yerushalayim? But I'll be honest with you, I'm very happy they say it because it's the two times a year when I can reach Shishtabach with the rest of the davening. What it takes me to say the few Mizmorim until they say, oh, Baruch Hashem, I don't have to rush like a racehorse to finish Shishtabach. I should be able to say Baruch Hu. But all right, we struggle. So if you recall a week ago, the Rav Hatzlich Galach Sich Ois, I don't know how to translate that. We'll let the Herbie translate. The Rav laughed at it. Well, what could he do? This is davening, and then Balabatim, who's the Mishrata Datat? He was totally opposed. All right. A number of years later, he changed his stance, and it came up again. Only this time, the changes were instituted. The davening came from the chief rabbinate. And listen to what the Rav had to say. Although I generally disapprove of meaningless ceremonials, I can hear the Rav's voice, I would acquiesce this time to the program recommended by the chief rabbinate of Israel. My change of heart is mainly prompted by historical realities. The fact that Israel is fighting on the international scene for her very existence warrants a public manifestation of our sympathy for her gallant struggle. A uniform service in all synagogues where members of the rabbinical council occupy pulpits would be an impressive demonstration. And that's a beautiful statement. And once again, you're seeing the Rav caught between the two different poles of thinking, klape chutz, klape pnim. What do? How do we relate? And the klape chutz here is much more important than the klape panim. Could be that saying these tehillim, making these additions and saying lechadodi halachically a nonsense. Doesn't make sense. Sekletzich nicht. Doesn't ring a bell. But klappe chutz, the world should see all the RCA Rabbanim are united. We stand with you, State of Israel, in your gallant battle for survival, victory, independence, greatness as a state among states. You can understand the rub. And this time, it came from the chief rabbinate, not from Bala Batim. Okay, beautiful, beautiful. Another question which comes up, and here already you see the Rav and relating to the American scene with a certain amount of cynicism and honesty. And very interesting where this question comes from. A student of mine, Shinab Rafua Shlema, is battling illness today, not corona, but that's heart problems. Joey Epstein. Joey and I go back a long way. And I knew his father. His father was the rabbi of Syracuse, Jacob Epstein. And he's the one that asked this question. Rabbi Jacob Epstein had a big Orthodox synagogue in Syracuse. He was a magnificent rabbi. I believe he was a graduate of Hebrew Theological College. I believe he's from the Chicago area. And you had a big shul. Blocks away, there's a young Israel, a small shul. Obviously, the young Israel has a different type of crowd. The big Orthodox shuls at that time had a handful of Orthodox Jews, mainly Jews with an Orthodox heart, but who lived a regular American type life. I see what you're holding up, what Joey Epstein put out on the Rav, recited in the Rav a number of times. Coming back here, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur is coming. Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, the shuls are fighting for their survival. You know what's going on in America today. They're going out of their minds. Can the shuls open for Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur? Nu l'mayna afkamina. I davened in my house Shabbos. Continue to daven in your house. Yeah, there's one tremendous nafkamina. Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, you sell seats. You bring in hundreds of thousands of dollars. You bring in the budget for the year. People davening in their house. All right, so they'll send $18 to the shul. But it's not membership, seats, income. Sakonet nefashet for the shuls. There's a real problem because Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur coming up and they're already talking in America. Go to the websites. What are we going to do? How can we work it out? And then you get tremendous crowds. It could be during the year you can divide the people up and let them sit 6 feet away from each other. Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, they're on top of each other. How do you divide them up? So the young Israel, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur coming, people want to go to shul. The young Israel inevitably is much smaller at that time than the big official Orthodox synagogue. So they rented a movie house where they're going to have a chazen with a choir with Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur davening. And of course, could you imagine you're renting a movie theater? Again, those of you who are younger don't know what I'm talking about. What's a movie theater? when we were growing up, RTO Palace, these movie theaters were temples, were structures, were beautiful. Sure. 1 o'clock in the afternoon, there's a double feature. The second feature stars Marilyn Monroe. I don't have to elaborate. Then they clean out the theater, and at 5:30, Rosh Hashanah services. 10 o'clock at night, another show of the movies right after the services end. And poor Rabbi Epstein turns to his organization, the RCA. Are you allowed to do that? Can you have services in a synagogue where before you begin, there'll be movies, after you end, there'll be movies, and in the middle, a chazan, a choir, an Orthodox Rosh Hashanah service, Yom Hadin. All right, this is the question. And Rabbi Epstein writes that the English Synagogue City had hired a movie house for high holiday services because of a lack of quarters for the people they wanted to attract. Movies would be shown after services and at night. There was an Orthodox synagogue 8 blocks away. That means his synagogue. And there was no emergency. Anyone who wants seats can go to the big Orthodox synagogue if the Yisrael is filled. And here you see Rabbi Soloveitchik answering word by word. Quote, we have not been consulted by the Young Israel of Syracuse. In other words, they never asked me whether you can hold services in a temple of movies of the ilk of Hollywood already by the 1950s. I don't want to mention the names of all the actresses, but Marilyn Monroe suffices. I still remember my youth. There was a Young Israel in the Bronx, and the rub was a Yudapayish rub, Rabbi Grunblatt, mit Abod, mit Langebuch Godem. And I remember I was once davening the Shabbos. Malka knew his daughter very well. I was davening a Shabbos, and I remember the president is speaking and ranting on about Marilyn Monroe. And I'm looking at the rabbi, wondering to myself, does he know what's going on? Or machzich nicht wissen, or he's just sitting there making believe, you know, it doesn't affect him. He doesn't know. He wants to keep his position in peace. But here's the rub. We have not been consulted by the inner circles. And I doubt, listen to this, that in the view, and I'm quoting the rub now, of the hostile attitude which has been displayed lately by the National Office of Young Israel, whether our opinion will carry weight. Could you imagine what the rub is saying? All right, this has to be researched. There's no question today there is tension between Young Israel and between RCA. This is why Rabbinic Alliance is on the map again. But even already in the 50s, Young Israel is Young Israel. And to a certain degree, you know, that a certain gaiva, that their shuls, the offices all have to be Shomrei Shabbos. You know what I'm saying? That's by the charter of Young Israel. So you can have Orthodox shuls at that time where you had a Rav, a Tzaddik, a Gaon, and the president was a Mechallel Shabbos. You can have a treasurer, a Neuchlin, a Vela from Treifat. It was all possible. Young Israel, all right. On the other hand, the other shuls, of course, were bigger, larger, much more outreach, etc. And here's the Rav. Our interference in this feud is contrary to my better judgment. Halachically, I'm quoting the Rav, a synagogue may be converted into a theater, but a theater may not be converted into a theater, but a theater could be used for a synagogue. Rented quarters not consecrated for a synagogue do not render those who rent them responsible what happens in Zen at other times. In other words, I rent the quarters, so what happens when we're not davening is not my achrayat. I'm only a tenant. The problem of the Torah scroll might come under the heading of the law prohibiting cohabitation in a house that has a Torah scroll or uncovered phylacteries. The law is probably more inclusive than the obvious meaning. An arc of 4 times 4 times 10 spans or a separation would be required. So far he's dealing with it halachically. Tell me, do you recognize this question? Reb Moshe Feinstein has a very, very similar question from St. Louis, where they want to rent a ballroom. I believe there too it was a young Israel. You can check it out. It's in the first volume of Or HaChaim, where they want to rent a ballroom for Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. But their problem is that during the year, the ballroom is used for events which include mixed dancing, social dancing. Can you rent a ballroom for Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, which has such events during the year? The Rav's answer would seem to be that you could rent it, but you have to build a mechitza for the Torah scroll. Where my son-in-law is president of the shul on Rehov, right off Palmach, the side street, the entrance is on the side street, half a block from the Shtiblach, half a block from the Mikvah of Katamon. So during that building is owned by the city. Although the shul has rights to it, and Baruch Hashem, they're very respectful of each other. And during the week, there are all types of courses there and classes there. And they have the Aron Kodesh is enclosed, the Aron Kodesh within a total major framework that totally separates it from what's going on during the week. Not that anything is totally chulin in that sense, but it's not respectful for the Aron Kodesh. So that, of course, is what the Rebbe is saying here, but that's purely halachically. The initial could come along and say, well, we're putting up a tremendous mechitza. When we go out of the shul, we lock up the Aron Kodesh, we seal it, one mechitza within another mechitza. But then the Rebbe says, from a practical angle, a religious service in a theater is undignified and in bad taste. It may also have repercussions as far as public opinion is concerned and undermine the little respect which orthodoxy still earns. This is not the first time that the young Israel has wrapped itself in the mantle of a liar and in the name of Yahadut, and engages in activities which are detrimental to our cause. However, we can do nothing about it. Quote, end quote. Very, very fascinating statement, very fascinating document. And, you know, as far as having services in a theater, movies, it's again, takes us into the same realm of bingo in the synagogue, which we mentioned last week. And I don't want to paskin la halacha because each case would depend upon individual circumstances. I have a feeling that you probably have some Chabad houses across the world that began Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur having to rent space in buildings that were not exactly synagogues and not built for that reason. But all right, b'leit breira, if you can do it and sanctify the Aron HaKodesh and keep it properly and respect the Sifrei Torah, eit lasot l'Hashem. But what's fascinating here is the Rav's attitude towards young Israel at that moment in time. And Tishrei, Yom Kippur, wraps itself in the mantle of Elijah and engages in activities which are detrimental to our cause. However, we can do nothing about it. And that's an interesting statement. It comes to the fore. Someone enterprising one day can do a doctoral thesis on Young Israel, its relationship with other Orthodox institutions. And even today, we have to hit head on the question of Young Israel and Union of Orthodox Congregations. What is their relationship? How do they respect each other? How do they interact? Very fascinating topic. And this is the reality. This is the rub. This is the 1950s. It's thankful we have to be to Louis Bernstein for recording all these incidents. If not for Louis Bernstein, it would all be lost. So let me reiterate. I have to end, we have to be out of here by 11 o'clock, out of the classroom, so you can have time to catch your breath and get ready for my revered colleague, Rabbi Asaf Bednash, and his shiur. There's no question that with the Rav taking over as chairman of the Halachic Commission, RCA goes into a new era. The Rav, like many others of Gedolei Yisrael who are also involved in Machshava, Hashkafa, philosophy, his existence is not a simple one. The dialectical tension is constantly with us. You can see this not only with the Rav. Give you a simple example, Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg. You take Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, you take the Sri Deyesh, you take his writings. Who is Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg? And you can debate the question endlessly. Here you have a Lithuanian Gaon who is considered the outstanding Ilui of the yeshiva world, Slabatka, etc., going back 120 years. And this same individual, 20 years later, is getting a PhD in Berlin, becomes the head director of the Berlin Rabbinic Seminary. His publications range from Litvish Torah to Chachmat Yisrael, Tashkafa on many, many different levels, philosophy. Who is the real Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg? And the truth is, there are many layers to him. And you saw the same thing, exactly like what happened with the Rav, Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg. My student, Melech Shapiro, Mark Shapiro, did his brilliant doctorate under Professor Tversky, was the last doctorate done under Professor Tversky, on Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg. Look at the reviews. There were reviews that cursed him, maledicted him. You have no idea what went on, and reviews that praised him. And the truth is that I think more than anyone, Melech Shapiro got to Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg. It took someone who was exposed to YU to understand this dialectical existence, this dualism that can exist within one human being, and there's no contradiction, basically. But this is the result of his knowledge, his life structure, his understanding, his experience. And same thing with the Rav, the Klapei Chutz, Klapei Pnim. How do you define it? Where do you draw the line? What yes, what no? And here you see it for the first time in that interview with the Tongue, and the Rav never altered his position. With all the pressure and all the conflict and all the controversy, the Rav remained true to his position. And his wonderful disciples, Rabbi Hollander was right, but he saw the Rav klapei pnim. Louis Bernstein was right, but he saw the Rav klapei chutz. You understand? It's not that they misinterpreted the Rav, but each one through his own prisma, digested the Rav in accordance with his own life experience and outlook. And very powerful questions. The Israeli army vis-a-vis the American army, so you can say, Ashreinu Shezachinu, that at least these problems we don't have in the Israeli army. And by the way, I can tell you something else. If you call a rabbi in the Israeli army a chaplain, that's incorrect. The Israeli army, the rabbis are frontline soldiers, and they all carry weapons when they're required to. It's not like the chaplaincy everywhere else in the world. They're an integral part of the army, but their responsibility is Shabbat, Kashrut, personal status, helping soldiers, etc. But the minute my unit crossed into Lebanon back in the first Lebanese war, each one of us had to have a loaded gun on us. We are regular soldiers. In that sense, we are not chaplains. Now, the Young Israel question, and I hope it should be the words we mentioned, L'Refua Shleima for Avraham Yosef ben Malka, that's Joey Epstein, Harab, Avraham Yosef ben Malka, L'Refua Shleima. That's a fascinating question. You can tie it in with Reb Moshe. The real answer is that it depends on the exigencies of the situation. You have to know where the question is being asked, what the circumstances are. Obviously, you have to be able to be mechabed the Torah properly. What the Rav talks about, the behavior which is not decorous for an Aron Kodesh, for a Torah. So the Rav says it expands to more. You have to use common sense, and having it in a movie theater where Rosh Hashanah davening is followed by Marilyn Monroe, I understand exactly what the Rav is saying. But on the other hand, the Rav is a realist, and he saw that he dead ends with the Young Israel at this moment in time. As far as I know, and Jay can correct me, in Boston, the Rav had a wonderful relationship with the Young Israel of Brookline. Am I correct? Jay is shaking his head, yes. So, all right, what he said here has to be researched. My dear students, on Sunday, I pick up exactly where I left off. I'm going to show you something amazing about the Erev controversy, which does not escape us. From there, we move into a very interesting question. Can you wear glasses going out of your house on Shabbos? And that ties in, by the way, with Chovevei Torah, as you will see. But it's a very fascinating question that it opens. I think I'll be able to help you understand the whole union of Hotza'ah, what's involved, the Kli, a Tachshit, a Malbush, what the difference is, etc. There's a good Umreiden, the subject. We'll work it out. There's Rat Hashem, Mekavod L'Tiferet. When it comes to the Monday class, I hope next week that Jack can open up the IOU list. We have more to go. I'm going to say something interesting with Chicago and New York. And then we have to sail in to the Ketuvah issue, which gives birth to the joint base, and which is one of the most fascinating topics in the history of Torah in the 20th century. Halavai, someone listening, Halavai Yomo should have a Yetzer HaTov to do a doctorate and do it on this very topic, the joint bacon. Wow. Brings the Rav to life, Professor Liebman to life, and wait till you see the Orthodox, the conservative, the inside story. And I'm very thankful a scholarly article appeared in the last few years that a little bit I knew, but what I knew was hearsay, and that article gives it to you from within. My dear students, I want to thank you, and I want to mention all those listening across the wide expanse of Jewish existence. Thank you for honoring me with your presence. I look forward to the day we can shake hands with each other and rub each other in oxygen, sitting the way classes have been conducted from time immemorial. But as I said to David Gleischer, David, had you told me in 1965 or so that one day will come that I'm going to be sitting here in my cramped little apartment looking at a little gizmo, a screen with my granddaughter opposite me, and being saying thankful to Morty Carrigan for handling all the technical matters. That's the way I'd be teaching Torah. I would say, tell me better, I'll be jumping off the moon. Until we meet again in health and happiness, Das Vedanya, class is ended. Morty, get ready for the next Shein.